This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today on Takes on the World, Professor Lee Art, to discuss the situation in Venezuela, is Professor of Media Studies at Purdue University Northwest, where he teaches courses in mass communication, media theory, international communication, and persuasion in social movements. Before coming to Purdue, he taught at Loyola University Chicago, the University of Iowa, and Stanford. Dr. Arntz has written numerous articles on media influence, cultural diversity, and democratic communication for leading journals. His edited books include Marxism and Communication, The Point is to Change It, The Media Globe, Trends in International Communication, Bring 'Em On, Media and Politics in the Iraq War, The Globalization of Corporate Media Hegemony, Public Media and the Public Interest, Communication and Democratic Society, and Cultural Hegemony in the United States. He has also won a number of awards for his work. It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Lee Art to Takes on the World.
Hi, Jeff. Good to talk to you.
I'm glad to have you with us. In considering the situation in Venezuela, which you're about to discuss, I'd like to begin with you elaborating on something you said in a recent interview, which is key to understanding U.S. foreign policy, particularly, but not exclusively, for Latin America. What you said was, quote, "The U.S. only recognizes elections when it agrees with the outcome."
Yes, it's interesting that the media participates in this as well, but the mantra of democracy and elections and freedom is kind of a moving frame. Elections seem acceptable and preferable if the outcome is something that the victor is somebody that the U.S. has already determined that they could work with or would be an ally. So, I mean, when we think about Egypt, where there was a democratically elected government and the President Morsi was overthrown with a military coup, and then shortly thereafter, the military had an election and surprised General Sisi won the election, and the U.S. White House sent a statement, said, "Congratulations on your electoral victory." Whereas in Venezuela, where Maduro got 68% of the vote, they said that it was fraudulent, that there were irregularities, that we can't support the outcome of the election because it was obvious that the majority of people supported Maduro. So it's a shifting rubric. It's a shifting thermometer of how they're going to measure whether or not they will accept any particular election. Venezuela is a textbook case of that.
Well, we also have a situation in Honduras where most of the migrants at the border come from. We supported, this is under the Obama administration, supported a coup against President Zelaya in Honduras in 2009. I remember there was an email pilfered by WikiLeaks in which Hillary Clinton said, "We can't let Zelaya back in office." And the U.S. did not recognize under Obama as a coup. And then just 2017, you mentioned the other in that interview I saw, not allowing the person who won the election in 2017 to come into office. And the media and the Trump administration, which was the only, as I recall, the only government in Latin America, the Americas, to recognize the Honduran government, they wanted a re-election. The media went along with it.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, there's numerous examples. Haiti, there's been two cases where Aristide won the election. The last time Aristide won the election, the U.S. Marines basically kidnapped him and flew him to Africa. So, I mean, this is, as I said, it's not unusual. The rubric that says we think elections are good all depends on who the outcome is. I mean, it's true in Palestine. They weren't going to recognize Hamas because they determined that it was a terrorist group, even though that's what the majority of people voted as a government in Gaza. So it's always a shifting yardstick. It's a shifting goalpost. And anybody that is fighting for democracy or fighting to expand social services or public services is going to be up against the U.S., the U.K., Canada, a few other governments are going to always criticize the electoral process for being less than stellar if they don't like it. If they do like the outcome, then all kinds of things are accepted and tolerated. I mean, in Colombia and Mexico, journalists have been assassinated. Candidates for office have been assassinated, but they're still considered legitimate elections by the U.S. media and most of the U.S. politicians. It's quite extreme.
And our media seems to go along with it. You've written, that's one of your specialties, media studies is your specialty. And you see there's no real questioning of this in any of our media. And here, take, for example, this so-called humanitarian aid that was sent down by the Trump administration to the Colombia-Venezuelan border. And you pointed out that the hypocrisy involved in that whole operation. Perhaps you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, the media in general accepts, and this is true, again, in the UK or Canada, and most countries, the media will accept the government as the arbiter of the truth or the accuracy of whatever claims are made by their government anywhere in the world. And so you're already going in at a handicap, because if you're going to accept Abrams or the Trump administration or John Bolton as the source of news and information, you've already kind of lost half of the battle. But even after that, the media doesn't even do a decent job of checking their sources and checking the facts. A good example is the recognition of Guaido as an interim president based upon what he says is the Constitution's Article 233. In classes at Purdue, we would have at least asked our journalism students to go check Article 233 in the Venezuelan Constitution. And lo and behold, there's nothing in there about the National Assembly president, who is not elected, would take over in the absence of a president. And it also has a number of other sections that are just ignored. They basically take the word of Guaido and, by extension, the word of the U.S. ambassador as sufficient for presenting to the American people that this guy is a legitimate president. They say most countries in the world, which is not accurate either. There's some 40 countries that may have recognized Guaido, but the entire United Nations General Assembly did not recognize this. More than 100 countries don't recognize him. The humanitarian aid that the U.S. claimed they were bringing to Venezuela was the Red Cross. The International Red Cross refused to participate in that because they said this is not humanitarian aid. It's a political maneuver. The United Nations refused to recognize it as humanitarian aid, even while they were extending humanitarian aid and they made an agreement with Venezuela. And aid's been coming in from the U.N., but to read the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or the San Francisco Chronicle, you would not know that. You would only know about this minuscule fake aid that the U.S. proposed to bring across the Colombian border. They don't tell you the Red Cross, the U.N., Caritas, the Catholic Charities wanted nothing to do with it, and they don't tell you, meanwhile, that there's humanitarian aid coming in from the U.N., to Venezuela with the agreement and participation of the Venezuelan government. It's quite, again, it's quite egregious because it's so contemporary. But I don't hold the American public responsible because there's no other way of finding out information on this. Whether you're reading print magazines or newspapers or watching ABC or CNN, it's pretty much a blanket statement. And so there's no way to break out of that. And it puts the public at a real disadvantage for discussing and deciding what U.S. foreign policy should be.
Then we are told that the Venezuelan army burned the trucks carrying the aid when photographs showed that was a lie.
Right. Well, every once in a while, it's kind of like in Ferguson, where there was a videotape of the cop shooting an unarmed black man. There was somebody that actually videotaped the bombing of the trucks at the Colombian border, and turns out it wasn't the Venezuelan army, but it was Guaido supporters that firebombed their own trucks to try to create a media spectacle. But the interesting thing was somebody actually videotaped it, and CNN, for one, had to retract their statement because here's the live actual footage of what actually happened, and they had to retract what they had said the days before. I also think it's easy for us to get caught up in some of the details of that and lose sight of the larger geopolitical and the larger threat that Venezuela seems to pose to United States government or the United States corporate interests. I mean, we're supposed to have bleeding hearts because $20 million of aid was not allowed into Venezuela at the Colombian border. But we are not told, it does not get headlines, that U.S. sanctions are costing $30 million every single day. If the U.S. was interested in humanitarian aid, the sanctions would be ended, and there would be $30 million a day in revenues that could flow to and from Venezuela, which would more than make up for whatever humanitarian crisis has been caused by the sanctions. But they don't tell us that there's been, you know, $300 billion in sanctions have been lost. They don't tell us that the U.S. decision to basically steal Citgo and take a company and its $7 billion of profits and not allow that to be available to Venezuela. They don't tell you that Brazil has not been able to pay its $1 billion debt for electricity that they owe to Venezuela, or that the British government has absconded with more than $1 billion in gold reserves that was parked in a bank there that belongs to Venezuela. You start adding all this up, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's been going on for at least 5 or 6 years, if not longer. And instead, our attention is directed very spectacularly to this $20 million of aid that's supposed to solve the crisis that's been caused by sanctions by Canada, the United States, Brazil, that is really the source of the primary economic crises in Venezuela. So it's we're at a real disadvantage to be relying upon the major media in the U.S. or Canada to get information about Venezuela.
My guest is Dr. Lee Arts, and you guessed we're talking about Venezuela. And as you mentioned, 5 or 6 years, it is a mistake to blame this, what's happening today on the Trump administration, because our President Obama said... declared Venezuela to be an extraordinary threat to the world. And I remember that, and I don't remember any outcry at this ridiculous kind of statement. One might anticipate that coming from a George Bush or Donald Trump, from Obama, and he's never had to answer for it.
Yes, yes. And it's I was talking about the sanctions, the extreme sanctions and the boycott of trade with Venezuela and blocking other countries from doing trade. But you're right. This has been going on since about a year after Hugo Chavez was elected president in a coup that took place in 2002 against the elected president. The interesting thing is, despite all the outcry about the elections, in 2017, the U.S. participated, knew about the coup against Chavez in 2002, and the New York Times wrote an editorial that said, finally, democracy will be restored. What rational thinking or logical thinking can wrap our heads around the idea that here's an elected president, there was a coup led by private business and the private media in Venezuela that shut down all the other media, that said the Constitution no longer applies and we're going to take over and we will call elections later. And the New York Times says this is an advance for democracy, and the U.S. and Israel are there may have been more, but those are the only two governments I know that recognized the coup in 2002. And since that time, the U.S. has been spending upwards of $10 million a year through the National Endowment for Democracy and both the Democratic and Republican parties' international freedom committees have been involved in financing opposition groups, student groups, civic groups to oppose the Venezuelan government. It's been going on for at least 20 years. Probably the most immediate economic problem was when the bottom dropped out of the oil prices as Saudi Arabia increased its production and the United States began fracking and increased its production. The bottom fell out of the oil market. So prices that were $130 a barrel fell to about $30 a barrel. That's a huge loss in a country like Venezuela because that difference in $100 a barrel did not go to a private corporation like Exxon or BP, but that money went into a social fund that paid for building 13 new universities, building more than 2 million housing units, essentially wiping out illiteracy. The UN UNESCO recognized Venezuela for its progress on literacy. They won an award from the World Health Organization for their reduction in poverty and their improvement in nutrition. And all of this was because Venezuela was using the proceeds from their oil resources for public services, for public good. And that is, I would say, that's the biggest threat that was posed to the United States, was that the wealth of that nation was being used for that population, for education, for health, for housing, for nutrition. And that crisis that comes is when the ability to sell that oil on the world market is disrupted. And then you add to that the boycott and the sanctions that makes it almost impossible even to get repair parts to continue to drill and refine the oil. You can't get repair parts because of the sanctions. So it really does create a crisis, but it's not a crisis that was caused primarily by Venezuela. It was a crisis that was primarily caused by U.S. And some EU countries and Canadian intervention to disrupt that society and that social order.
Well, you also have referred in the past to the threat to the United States of a good example. That elaborate. Other countries seeing how Venezuela worked would be likely to emulate it. But then when they see the U.S. reaction to it, they realize there's a price to pay for trying to actually serve the people.
Yeah, I cannot imagine being in a position of making decisions for Venezuela, the government and its policies. But you're right, it's kind of caught in the crosshairs at this moment. But I think it's much more than oil. Obviously, oil and gold and other natural resources are abundant in Venezuela. And as John Bolton said, the U.S. would like to get that stuff into the hands of private U.S. corporations. But the bigger concern, I think, is Venezuela was setting an example for all of Latin America. For a while, they called it the pink tide because there were democratic elections that brought to power progressives in Bolivia and Ecuador and Uruguay, even to some extent in Argentina, and probably was preceded a bit by Lula in Brazil. This created a real scare among American corporations and the American government. As you said, it was clear that was true in the Obama administration, too, because the threat was, let's use the wealth that's been created by the population to benefit those people that have created the wealth. And that's what was happening in Venezuela, the reduction of poverty, the disappearance of extreme poverty, the disappearance of illiteracy, the housing. I mean, the entire social welfare in Venezuela was, you know, something that we could emulate, that we could learn from. The interesting thing is the media did not report on that. In 20 years, The Guardian had like two stories on what the social changes were in Venezuela, and you would be hard-pressed to find any stories on the television news in the U.S. and very limited in the print. So the American people don't know why suddenly Venezuela's in the news. We just are told that this is some authoritarian president and there's people in Venezuela that want him gone without having any understanding of the social divisions and the social progress that has occurred miraculously, I would argue, in Venezuela. Things that we could learn from. I mean, could I mean, could people in California imagine if PGE was a public utility, not a private utility, and that rather than profits going to some shareholders, that money was used to build infrastructure, renewable energy, and to benefit the people of California? What a concept. What a concept. And that's what's been done in Venezuela. And the last thing PG&E or Trump or Obama or the Democrats or Republicans want the American people to know, that there is an alternative to what we've been told is only through the free market and only through this getting the return for the shareholders. And that's the threat that Venezuela has posed. And that's why it's in the sights of the United States government right now.
And now they have escalated the situation. Monday we had another blackout, and it seems that there's a history going back to 2010, of when Chavez was still in power, of trying to sabotage the electric grid. And one comment was made, there was a group called Canvas, of a soft power political group. The U.S. has been doing this for years, of course, with the National Endowment for Democracy. But well, the idea was that a power blackout destroying the grid could do more to destabilize the country and deliver the result the United States wants than any kind of mobilization. Actually, comment on that.
Yes, I mean, we don't know what the cyber failure was that locked down the electrical grid. There's some interesting things that occurred immediately within the within just a few minutes. Marco Rubio was twittering that they've lost power in Venezuela, details that even the Venezuela government didn't have. How he would know that, I don't know. Maybe he's an expert in cybersecurity, or maybe he's an expert in electrical power. But the interesting thing was he knew it before people in Venezuela knew what the problem was. And then Mike Pompeo, immediately after the blackout, he said, well, no food, no medicine, now no power. Again, it was part of the U.S. policy, whether the U.S. was directly involved in the crash of the electrical grid. We may not know for a long time, and they may not have been, but certainly this fits the playbook all the way back to Nicaragua, where the U.S. was mining the harbor in Corinto that would blow up ships that were trying to trade with Nicaragua. This is not something that is beyond both what Trump and Obama would say, black ops, special ops. All options are on the table. In fact, that has been some of the advice that has come from the CIA and National Endowment for Democracy, that often it's better to intervene surreptitiously, or certainly with people within the country, rather than trying a direct military intervention. And this fits that playbook.
Well, Trump has asked for $500 million to support intervention in Venezuela, and there's speculation whether the U.S. would send troops. You have suggested that there might be a bombing campaign. I thought perhaps they would fund the Brazilian and Colombian armies to intervene. What do you think of that possibility?
I think that the immediate issue was probably back on February 23rd when they staged the kind of the fake humanitarian aid intervention. But Guaido, who is not known by more than 80% of the people in Venezuela and was not elected to his post, it was kind of fell to him by default, assured the U.S. Advisors that the military and the Venezuelan people would rise up and be at the border and welcoming him. That didn't happen. And as a consequence, Colombia, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Peru, some of the other countries realized very quickly that there isn't a groundswell of support for Guaido, but in fact, the majority of the population is solidly supporting the social changes that have happened under Chavez and the Venezuelan Socialist Party. So that makes it more difficult. And I can say that because just recently, Bolsonaro, the new president in Brazil, was at the White House, and shaking hands with Trump and doing their photo ops. And he was asked directly, is Brazil interested in intervention or does Brazil support U.S. intervention in Venezuela? And he refused to answer it. I think they realized that that would be disastrous for their own governments, for their own political life in both Brazil and Colombia, to try to do some intervention with or without the cover of U.S. support. You add to that the military in Venezuela is an advanced, well-organized, well-armed military. In addition to that, there's more than 1 million people in popular militias, national guards, that have been trained and armed. We're not talking about invading some country where, you know, the people are uneducated, they're unarmed, they are not supportive of their government, and they will, you know, welcome the U.S. We're not even talking about a situation like in Iraq where there was a military, but there was no public support for Hussein when the U.S. began bombing and then intervened. That's not true in Venezuela, and Bolsonaro and Colombia, Duque, both have backed off of that quite significantly. I say that doesn't mean, you know, the current White House couldn't on a whim decide to take some action, but I think they've just created a larger problem for themselves by backing somebody like Guaido that has no, I mean, even within the political opposition in Venezuela, Guaido is not respected or supported. Even outside of Popular Well, the little party that he is a member of, Capriles and Borges and some of the others that are part of the opposition, even the opposition in the National Assembly, don't see him as a viable leader. So he was basically a charlatan, a shell for orchestrating some kind of disruption, and it did not pan out the way the U.S. had hoped it. What's their next step? I don't know. There is a growing opposition to U.S. sanctions internationally. The U.N. has rejected them as unacceptable. The U.N. rapporteur to Venezuela, De Zayas, has said that the U.S. could easily be charged with crimes against humanity for their sanctions. Everybody from the National Labor Council in Canada that voted unanimously against U.S. sanctions, to the Chicago Teachers Union, to the San Francisco AFL-CIO Labor Council. Around the world, there's opposition to the U.S. policy, which does not guarantee that they won't do something irrational or unexpected. It just suggests that there's not this groundswell of support for the U.S. campaign to isolate Venezuela. And then you add to that trade with China and trade with Russia and purchase of military equipment from Russia. It really complicates matters and kind of isolates the United States on the world stage.
My guest again is Dr. Lee Arts, and you guess we're talking about Venezuela. It's interesting that it was reported that on the 22nd of January, Guaido met with Mike Pence, or spoke with Mike Pence, vice president, and the very next day is when he declared his presidency.
Remarkable
coincidence. He's very telegenic, and obviously this is for an American audience, young, good-looking, like a movie actor. But as you say, the majority of Venezuelans didn't know who this guy was. It's an extraordinary situation. I'm interested in
The irony here is that Guaido was elected with 21% of the vote in the state of Vargas to be in an alternate deputy to the National Assembly. The interesting thing is those are the same laws and regulations by which Maduro was elected president. And that's my point. Guaido gets elected under those rules, those regulations, that system of voting, and it's considered legitimate because he got elected. But then how did he become the president of the National Assembly? Well, the National Assembly agreed among the four opposition parties that they would rotate the presidency. And this year it was Popular Well's turn. The problem with Popular Well is their leader, Leopoldo Lopez, is under house arrest for crimes against civilians. for inciting to violence. The second member in lead of the Popular Well fled to Chile because he was charged with crimes against civilians. And the third member was so associated with the wealthy and ridiculed by the general population that he was not acceptable. So now we're down to the fourth level of a party that's only part of the opposition that didn't get elected to National Assembly. For an alternate deputy that gets 21% of the vote, and he talks to Mike Pence, and he declares himself president of the Republic of Venezuela. It's just, on the face of it, it's absurd. If it was dramatic and so a threat to humanity, it would make for a great a sitcom or one of those great movie spoofs of how would someone become president. And Guaido is not new to this. He went to George Washington University. His mentor was an executive director of the IMF. He was part of Generation 7, which was one of those funded U.S. operations that organized violent student protests in 2007 against the Venezuelan government. And Guaido was on the front lines. They've even showed Facebook pages of him throwing incendiary bombs and flashing his behind to the camera. And this is the guy that the U.S. has said is a legitimate leader of a population. When we get to the details, it becomes ridiculous, if not dangerously absurd. And it's hard to even fathom that this is happening.
Well, when they appointed Elliot Abrams, that as far as I'm concerned, open the door for anything. And the fact that there was an outrage, any expressed, at least publicly, from the Democratic Party, our presidential candidates, to my knowledge, I'm not aware they're even speaking at all about U.S. foreign policy. I'm curious about our military's interest in Venezuela, because they do differ with the Trump junta group when it comes to Iran, and I'm just wondering what the U.S. military thinks about Venezuela. They're not as aggressive, at least in the Middle East at the moment, as they have been in the past. So I'm curious if you've seen statements from any U.S. military people about the Venezuelan situation.
None that I can make quick reference to. I think your larger point is interesting, that the stable of candidates for the Democratic Party nomination for president as a group has lined up in support of U.S. sanctions, or else at least not spoken out. I mean, Bernie Sanders did not speak out. He once referred to Maduro as a dictator. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said that she has to study it. I don't know what she would have to study. To the best of my knowledge, the only one is a woman from Hawaii that said there should be no U.S. sanctions on Venezuela and we should abide by international law. And I think the rep there in California, Ro Khanna, has spoken out. In fact, there's 60 congresspeople that have said that there should not be sanctions and the U.S. should not be considering military intervention for one reason or another. But again, that's not front page news. When you come down from Nancy Pelosi to other leading candidates, there seems to be a lockstep with this kind of quotation marks U.S. interest in Venezuela, and that there's an authoritarian leadership, which is just, it flies in the face of the reality of people that live in Venezuela. And that should be disturbing to every American. The two parties that you have to look to for foreign policy and domestic policy seem to line up and see Venezuela's public education, free college education, national health care, a program for housing, a program to reduce poverty, to increase nutrition. For some reason, this stable of Democratic candidates don't see this as a positive model that could be emulated and, in fact, extended and enhanced in the United States. Instead, they are, I would say, kowtowing to the people that they hope are going to give them money to run for the election. So they're not going to speak against Exxon or Mobil or General Motors or any of the others that have interests in Venezuela.
Well, Dr. Lee Art, a couple of things before we've come to the end of the hour. How do people reach you? And also, what sources do you recommend for the listeners to get more information on Venezuela?
I can be reached by email at artz@purdue.edu, and I'd be happy to share some of the documents and some of the writings that I've had on Venezuela and direct people to other sources. I would say the most important thing is try to find multiple sources, including outside the United States, whether that's the Canadian Broadcasting System or BBC or The Guardian or The Independent in Britain. There's also through the internet, you can access Telesur, TELESUR.com, which is a public television network for Latin America, and they have both television and print reports on the region, especially on Venezuela. I'd say that would be a great source, Telesur. Another one would be Venezuela Analysis. That's all one word, VenezuelaAnalysis.com, which was started by a U.S. professor, and there's freelance journalists and independent reporters that are in Venezuela that weekly provide news and information on culture, politics, economics, and also opinion pieces on Venezuela. So,
well, thank you so much.
Easily available, Telesur and Venezuela Analysis.
Thanks so much for that, and thanks so much for being our guest today in Takes on the World. Look forward to speaking with you again, Dr. Lee Art.
Thank you, Jeff. Anytime.
Okay,
thank
take
you.
Care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.